This is the first lab meeting that's fairly normal, which means that it's not just me talking the whole time, although I do have to say some stuff today that actually takes even longer than what you're going to be doing. But it's normal in the sense that you have an activity to do today. More specifically, you have an actual experiment to conduct, which isn't always true. And one thing that is kind of unusual compared to most weeks is that this is one of the week's activities that you have to write up as a report. So this will be the first of three reports. You don't write that today. You write that individually at home before the due date. Just let me remind you that no matter what the manual says, which is written by a different instructor for her own section, you are never handing me hard copies of lab reports. It's one thing that you submit, and Canvas will not accept it if it's not Doc or DocX. So it's a Word document, one thing that you submit. But you'll have pictures that you need to include, like a picture of a graph that you draw, for instance. You just need to insert that into the document so that you're uploading one Word document. All right. I don't have the due date memorized, but it's been up there for a while already on Canvas. Just make a note of it. You don't want to do this in 10 minutes right before the deadline. Also, these are not formal reports with like materials and methods and formal sections. It's simply a matter of answering the things that are on the page in the manual that's called, I think, Lab Report Directions, I think it's called. It's at the end of this chapter that we're doing today. One final thing, or one other thing, it might not be the final thing if I think of something else. You are working in groups in here, and I don't care how you form groups. It can be how you're sitting right now. You can rearrange yourselves. It doesn't matter. But work as a table. You know, each table is a group to do today's experiment. That means that everyone in the group, not only are you helping out doing whatever you're doing, everyone in the group will have the same data. Different tables will have different data. But you're sharing data within the group. That's all you're sharing. It's fine to talk about things and figure things out together. But when it comes to actually writing your report, you have to do that on your own. This goes back to the rules consent form you had to submit, right? Don't have one person make a graph and everyone uses that graph. That's cheating. Everyone has to do all of the report individually. And by the way, just when you're done today, in general, you don't have to stay any longer than what is required to do the activity. So in case you don't already know it, when you finish today and you've cleaned up, as long as you're sure that everyone has the data in your group, you don't have to wait around simply because there's class time left. Okay. As you see, I have a few important concepts to get through before I let you loose on the actual activity. The activity today actually doesn't take very long to get your raw data. And really, that's all you have to be here for, is to get the raw data. You can process it at home, do the report at home. But let's first of all, actually even before this first point, since we didn't do this last week like the other weeks, like the other sections, the other instructors did, I just want to make sure you know the official names of some basic equipment that we use throughout the term. What is this thing? It is a beaker. And a beaker is used to hold liquids. This also is, though, but it's not a beaker. What is this? This is a flask, which is really short for Erlenmeyer flask, but it's fine to just call it a flask. Notice they both have markings on them indicating volumes. This is a test tube holder, just to clamp onto a test tube when you're using them so you don't have to touch the tube itself. Many of you might guess this is a Bunsen burner, but it's a Fisher burner, actually. But you can call it just a burner. You don't use this today, but we will eventually. This is one of several different sizes of things that are called pipettes. It's a glass tube, basically, but with graduations marking volumes. Pipettes are used for careful measurements of liquids of or volumes of liquid, not only measuring their volumes, but dispensing them. This instrument does the same thing, but it has a different name. This is a graduated cylinder, named for the fact that it's cylindrical and it has graduations, little tick marks. This thing is both a heater and a magnetic stirrer. That's why it has two controls. So, like the one you're using today, which is only a heater, when you turn it on, it will get hot. So, once you do that today, make sure you don't put your hand on it, because you can't tell it's hot. Anyway, you can heat things up on this, but if it's a stirrer also, like this one is, you turn the magnet on, it will spin in there, and if you have a magnet in your beaker or flask, it will twirl and stir the liquid. This is just a little microcentrifuge tube. We'll use a centrifuge later. This is a vortexer. A vortexer is a way to mix ingredients in a liquid to make it homogeneous, because when you have it turned on and you press the tube down, it's not plugged in, it will spin to cause a little vortex. So that mixes things together. This is kind of the opposite. This is a centrifuge, which doesn't mix things together. It separates ingredients by spinning them in these tubes, and the heavier stuff falls to the bottom, the lighter stuff floats above. This is another careful volume measurement device. It is a micropipetter. I mentioned pipettes. There's all kinds of different sizes of those. Those are for comparatively larger volumes, because you use your eye to actually make the determination of the volume. But for very tiny volumes where your eye wouldn't be good enough, you use a micropipetter with a tip. This doesn't have a tip on it, but we'll use these later, and when we do, I'll demonstrate how to properly use them. Just know that its name is a micropipetter. And this is a sparker with a bad flint in it, but it usually would spark so that you can light the burner. If you have a lighter on you, you can also do that. All right, now that that's over with, let's talk about careful liquid measurement. For all kinds of reasons, in not just biology labs, but scientific labs in general, it's important to carefully measure volumes of liquid, including today, because we're dealing with volumes of liquid today. There's all kinds of different things you can use for that. Like I said earlier, the beaker and the flask both have graduations on them. They're marked with volumes. So technically you can use them to measure liquid volumes, but they should never be your first choice. That's just a pretty much rough idea of how much volume there is, so you're just not totally clueless. You wouldn't use a beaker or a flask to carefully measure the volume of a liquid. Instead, you would use either a graduated cylinder or a pipette, or a micropipette, or depending on the volume you're interested in measuring. But when you get down to it, a graduated cylinder is a cylinder just like the beaker is. The beaker is cylindrical as well. What makes the graduated cylinder better as far as accuracy and resolution of measurement of the volume is concerned? What is fundamentally different about the graduated cylinder as a cylinder compared to the beaker? Don't overthink this. If I ask a kindergartner what is different about that cylinder compared to that cylinder, what is it? It is taller, but it wouldn't have to be taller. Even if it were the same height, what would be different about it? It's narrower. It's a narrower cylinder, right? The graduated cylinder is much narrower than the wider cylinder. Well, if I imagine putting some volume of water into a big sheet pan, it's going to be hard to tell how much is there, right? because it's going to be spread out over such a wide area. And if you add another volume to that, it is going to change. It'll go up a little bit in the tray, but not very much, right? It would be hard to tell the difference in that change in volume. The bigger the diameter a container is. But when you have a narrow cylinder, any change in volume is going to make a big difference vertically, which is why you can see that change and match it up to tick marks a lot more with higher resolution and therefore more accurately. So, to carefully measure the volume of liquid, you should always use the smallest graduated cylinder that's big enough to do the job. If you think about measuring an entire liter of water, by the way, some graduated cylinders wouldn't be big enough to hold all of that. There are bigger graduated cylinders, but these wouldn't do the job, right? You could use them, but you would have to make multiple measurements. Keep emptying it and then adding more water, right? Make multiple measurements and then add those all together. The problem with that is that each individual measurement in science has some error associated with it. And if you, the more measurements you have to make, therefore, the more errors can add up. So that's why you use the smallest one that is still big enough to do the job with just one measurement. And for very small volumes, you wouldn't use a graduated cylinder. You use either a pipette, or even smaller than that, you would use a micropipetter. Okay, so that's part of careful liquid measurement. Let's talk about the meniscus, which you should already know about because you all did the pre-lab, right? Well, when you get liquid in a narrow cylinder, you don't see a nice level surface. Unfortunately, I say that because if you to use a graduated cylinder properly, you need to match up the level of the liquid with one of those tick marks. And therefore, it would be nice if the liquid formed a nice level surface so that you can definitely tell where the line is that it matches up with. I mean, you can definitely tell where it matches up on the tick marks. But that's not what happens with real liquids. They form concavities. In other words, the surface is curved, and that curvature is called a meniscus. There's two ways that can happen. This is an example of a negative meniscus, which is the only one you're likely to encounter, definitely the only one you'll encounter in this lab. Water forms a negative meniscus. It's a downward curvature. They're getting rare because no one wants to have the mercury around anymore, but if you look at an old mercury barometer, which is mercury in a tube, mercury forms a positive meniscus, an upward curvature. Both of these are inconvenient when it comes to measurement because they're ambiguous, right? Just make sense of this in your mind. If the true height of that column is somewhere between these extents, right? If you were to imagine pushing on this to force that curvature flat, that flatness would be somewhere between here and here, right? But you don't know where exactly. And that's why it's really impossible to properly measure a meniscus when it comes to the absolute truth. Same with a positive meniscus. It would be somewhere between there and there, but you can't tell where by looking. Since we can't tell, we've come to a convention, which means simply scientists get together and agree on doing something a certain way. Even though it's technically not the truth, we say that when you have a meniscus, whichever kind of meniscus it is, you pretend that the real level goes through the curved part, right at the bottom of a negative meniscus or the top of a positive meniscus. And so we just allow that error, because it is definitely an error, but if we do it the same way, we'll reduce variation. The reason water always forms a negative meniscus is because of the polarity we've been talking about today. It's called capillary attraction, but that's a meniscus. Now, to read a meniscus properly, and this is straightforward, but a lot of people don't do this correctly, you have to have your eye exactly at the level, horizontally, with the meniscus itself. In other words, you need to get down there, move your eye so it's right in front of the meniscus. Otherwise, you'll have what's called parallax error, which I can kind of demonstrate. If I put a mark here, then I hold up this marker in front of the mark, and I ask you, is that mark to the left or to the right of the marker? It depends on where you are looking at it, right? If you're way over here, it will be one answer. If you're way over there, it'll be another answer. But if you look at it straight on, that's the only way that it's proper to look at it. That's why you need to bother to, you know, don't just look at it for standing up and say, oh, that looks like 39 milliliters. Get down there and put your eye level there. Okay. Next, four definitions, all related. Solution, solvent, and solute, I'll start with, because they are very related, especially to today's stuff. A solution is just one kind of mixture. Mixture obviously involves different things put together. And a solution is a particular kind of mixture. Specifically, a solution is a fluid mixture. So we better talk about what a fluid is. What is a fluid? A lot of people use the word fluid interchangeably with liquid, but that's not right. Fluid as a word, as an adjective, means able to flow. So a fluid is either a liquid or a gas. It's not solid. Because both of them flow and therefore take the shape of whatever container they're in. Whereas a solid won't. It's a chunk that doesn't change shape. Okay, so a solution can be either a liquid or a gaseous mixture. Today it's a liquid mixture. But in any given solution, there are two components to that mixture, two categories of components. Go ahead.
Wouldn't sand also flow?
Well, not. You mean by just falling as particles?
Yeah, because I also like to say, also the fact. So there is some solid, but I don't think if you're like
you can
lab, but is there like circumstances where it could be considered fluid?
It would. There are other names for other mixtures that have solids in them. You know, like for instance, it can be a precipitant. It's falling from the other liquid population, and also things that are solid can have kind of the same properties as solutions, but solutions are fluids. And specifically for today, they're liquids. Okay? But there's two categories of components that make up the solution. In any given solution, though, something is dissolved in something else. And the thing that is being dissolved is the solute. Now, a solution can have more than one solute, but it has at least one solute, one thing that's being dissolved. The thing that is dissolving the other thing, the thing that's dissolving the solute, in other words, is the solvent. And there can also be more than one solvent, but there's typically one. The overall combination of solvent and solute is the solution. That's the whole thing. So we're using solutions today, right? Because we're making, it's already made. You just have to play around with it. But the solution is salt water. Actually, this is an example of a solution that actually has two solutes. We talked about table salt, sodium chloride, right, which is a compound, an ionic compound. But actually, when you put that into water, which is the solvent, the water molecules separate the two ion types from each other and surround them so that they can't be joined together anymore. So the salt is no longer sodium chloride, really, when it's in solution, even though we call it salt water. It's salt before you add it to the water, but when it's dissolved, it's really a solution that contains sodium ions and chloride ions, both in solution independently. There's really two solutes, therefore. By the way, any solution for which water is the solvent, which isn't always the case, but in biology it's pretty much always the case, is called an aqueous solution. That just means a solution using water as the solvent. Aqueous means watery. All right, so those are the definitions of those three S words. Molarity is just one way of expressing a solution's concentration. There are multiple ways to define concentration. But concentration, regardless of the definition, gives you an idea of the relative abundance of solutes in the solution. We can think of it as the strength of the solution. Like there's weak salt water and strong salt water in familiar terms, right? The saltier it is, the stronger it is. Well, that means the more concentrated it is as a solution. So multiple definitions for how you do that units-wise. Molarity is just one way, but it's the way we're going to use. And so it's the only one I'm really going to describe. Molarity has units called molar, which is abbreviated capital M. And that's not a conflict, by the way. You already know capital M means mega, but you would never use mega on its own, right, as a symbol. It would be capital M followed by whatever unit you're multiplying by a million. So megameters, for instance, is a million meters. Capital M by itself means molar. And it has... Well, it's an example of a derived unit, meaning it's made up of other units, right? Molar, capital M, is defined as moles of solute per liter of overall solution. So we can kind of see this back here with these bottles. These ones have been partially emptied, and you can use any one of them. There's more over here, so you don't have to wait on any of these bottles. But these all, I think, have a liter in them. So this is a liter of overall solution. When this used to be a liter as well. When it was full, this is a 5 molar concentration. It's listed. When it was full of a liter, that much volume of the overall solution contained 5 moles of salt, which is this much salt. 5 moles is 5 times Avogadro's number of particles, right? And that's the only reason these salt beakers are here. You don't open these up. This is just to give you a visual representation of how much is dissolved in a liter for that molarity. 5, 3, 1... And the zero molar solution today is technically not a solution, right? It's just pure water. All right, so that's molarity. Physical and chemical changes. Well, they're both changes, obviously. But you should already kind of know what a chemical change is based on what we've been saying in lecture. A chemical change happens when there's a chemical reaction, which means there is a change in substance. Right? Like sodium and chlorine reacting to form sodium chloride. That's a chemical change. You have new substance as a result. Not all changes are like that, though. For instance, state changes, changes in the state of matter, which we undergo today. Solid is a state, liquid is a state, gas is a state. Well, evaporation of water, for instance, that's not a chemical change, that's a physical change. Because in both states, you have exactly the same stuff. It's molecules of water. Like we talked about today, really the only difference is the spacing between them. So in that physical change, nothing, no new chemical is created. That's the big difference. Now we can get to variables and talk about experiments in general. Any given experiment involves many variables, really. But we can lump variables into three categories. Variables in general, though, are things that can vary. Their values can vary. What is the purpose of, first of all, doing an experiment? As far as the scientific method is concerned, what are you trying to accomplish with the actual experiment? What does it test? Indirectly, what does it directly test? You do indirectly test a hypothesis, but you do so by setting up an experiment to directly test that hypothesis corresponding prediction. Right? The test is designed to see whether the prediction that corresponds to a hypothesis actually will come true. So you're directly testing the prediction. You understand that? Okay. And if the prediction doesn't come true, either you made some drastic mistake or the hypothesis is false, at least partially. Okay. Well, you're testing specific things, though, in a test, in an experiment. And there's all kinds of other things that are not related to the experiment, but that could affect the outcome, right? You don't want those things that have nothing to do with what you're testing have an effect, actually. And those other things that could have an effect are variables as well. You just want to eliminate them from mattering, because then that'll cloud the results. So even though those other things are variables, they're called controlled variables, because you as the scientist are trying to keep them from varying. And by keeping them from varying, they shouldn't have an effect on your experiment. So let me give you an example. If I, in an experiment, am testing what the effect of the concentration of a nutrient solution is on the growth rate of a plant, there's all kinds of different variables that could affect the growth rate of the plant. I would want to keep them from having their effect. So, for instance, I would want to make sure that every different subject, every different plant that I use, gets the same amount of sunlight, gets the same amount of water, is the same species, is the same age and size to start with, same pot, same soil. Everything that I can control that would vary normally, which is why it's a variable, you're keeping them from varying. Those are the controlled variables, all lumped together as one category. All right? Then there are two other categories, the ones listed up there. Independent variable, dependent variable. And these are easy to confuse. Students confuse these often. Now, usually, as you've noticed in lecture, I like to explain things linguistically based on what the words mean, and they do make sense, but in this case I think it's better to just give you a practical definition to make the distinction between the two. By practical I mean how they are used. The independent variable in any given experiment is the thing that you adjust. You, the scientists, are adjusting the independent variable, meaning you're making it a different value for your different subjects. The dependent variable, on the other hand, is the thing that you as the scientist are measuring in the experiment. So let's just use the example I already gave you. What is the independent variable in that plant experiment? I wanted to figure out what the effect of the concentration of a nutrient solution is on the growth rate of a plant.
So then the independent variable would be like how high concentrated in each of them?
That's right. The independent variable in that example would be the concentration of nutrient solution. Notice that that is what I'm adjusting, because for one of these subjects I'm going to give it a certain concentration, the other one another concentration, and that's the only thing that's different about all of them. They all get exactly the same treatment as far as all the controlled variables are concerned. But the independent variable, I am the boss of that. I'm adjusting it from subject to subject. Okay? What's the dependent variable in the example?
The growth.
The growth rate, which is what I'm measuring, right? And so, linguistically, if you want to get back to that, use those practical definitions. But when you get back to the linguistics, which makes sense, what the experiment really boils down to is a way of determining whether the thing that we call the dependent variable, which is what we're measuring, actually does depend on what the value of the independent variable is. So, in this example, is it actually true that growth rate depends on nutrient solution concentration? That's why the words also make sense. But it's probably easier just to keep track of the fact that what you measure is always the dependent variable. What you adjust is the independent variable. So there's three categories of variables, but when we conduct science, we typically, in addition to words, display results in graphic form. We make graphs. Well, which of these three categories of variables doesn't belong on a graph? The controlled variables, which there's many of, right? Those are the things that you're just trying to make not matter at all. The other two, though, are part of the graph, independent and dependent variables. And there's only one proper way to graph those. Obviously, there's two dimensions on a two-dimensional graph. There's two axes. Which of these variables goes on the horizontal axis? The independent variable, the thing that you actually adjust, goes on the x or horizontal axis. So for mine, I would label that and I would write it out completely. Concentration of nutrient solution. But that wouldn't be enough because it doesn't tell me how I'm measuring concentration. Right? It doesn't tell me any units. Typically, you'll have units associated with an axis. And if there are units, which there usually are, those go in parentheses after the name. In this case, I would use molar, for instance. The dependent variable always goes on the y-axis. In my case, it's growth rate. Once again, I have to provide units, which I could choose any units I want, but let's just say millimeters per week. Right? That's what I'm measuring. That's by analogy with mathematical functions, the dependent variable is the output of the function, the y value that you get when you plug in the x value. Right? And more about the word dependent. If you make your measurements and you get these data, and I say these data because data is a plural word that's often misused as a singular word. It's data are, not data is. Anyway, if these all line up horizontally, they're all in a horizontal line, what does that tell you about growth rate compared to nutrient concentration? It means that it doesn't actually depend on the concentration, right? Well, we would still call this the dependent variable, but what we have shown in this case, if that came true, is that actually it turns out that growth rate does not depend on concentration. Just like a constant function, like y equals 3, does not depend on x. But for anything other than a zero slope or a horizontal line, there is a dependence, and that's why we call it the dependent variable. The value of it depends on the value of the independent variable, the input into the function, so to speak. All right, so let's say we didn't get those data, but these. Now, you should first of all notice that these things don't line up perfectly on a line. They're not collinear. And you shouldn't be surprised by that because these are real measurements which have real error associated with them, right? So you wouldn't expect them to be perfectly collinear, but they look like they're pretty collinear. And if you had made more measurements with more values of concentration, you could tell that even better. So when you see a trend like this, you are justified in drawing what's called a line of best fit. Which, if you're doing this by hand on a graph and you already have your dots in there, your real measurements, it's best to use a transparent ruler to do this because otherwise you'll hide some of the dots. But a line of best fit, which I'll just roughly draw like this, actually, that's a bad fit. A line of best fit does not necessarily go through any of the points. It might, but it doesn't have to. What makes it the line of best fit, so there's only one that's truly the best fit, is that it's the line that gets as close as possible to as many as possible of those points. And sometimes forcing it through one point or another will make it too far away from another. That's why it doesn't necessarily go through all of them, or any of them. Okay, by the way, there's more that I'm missing from this to be a complete graph. In addition to labels and units for my axes, I of course would have to have units and tick marks on my axes, right? Labeled appropriately. And I would have to have a good title, which seems to be a challenge for a lot of students. Here's an example of a really bad title to a graph. Bio 181. Or last week's lab. Those are terrible titles. The title of a graph should describe what's actually being displayed in the graph. It should be something about the experiment. Like effect of nutrient solution concentration on growth rate. Tells you what the actual experiment was testing. So I'm saying this because you'll need to include a graph, make sure it's complete in all these respects. Anyway, back to this line of best fit. We do this for a couple reasons. The less important reason is that a line of best fit makes the graph a lot easier to look at. Graphs are nice to begin with, compared to just words giving you numbers, because you can quickly see a correspondence or a dependence of one variable on the other just by glancing at it. And it makes it even easier when there's a line drawn. But the more important reason is that a line of best fit is a tool. It's a predictive tool. You can use it to make predictions. Now, in this case, there are only four data, right? Only four actual measurements were made here. Because only these concentrations, whatever they are the ones that I actually tested. But you could use any concentration, not just those ones that I tested. And you might be curious about what the growth rate would have been for some of those concentrations that you didn't actually measure for. That's what a line of best fit can be used to predict. And that brings up two processes that are really the same process, but we give two names to them: interpolation and extrapolation. They both use a trend line to make a prediction, but we distinguish them because one is a lot safer scientifically to do than the other. These words differ only in their prefix. What does inter mean? What is it? No. Inter means between, like international, between nations. Okay? Extra means outside of, like extraterrestrial, outside of Earth. And the reason they get this name is because though they both use the trend line to make a prediction, interpolation is using the trend line to make a prediction somewhere within the overall range of values of the independent variable that you used. This is the lowest one. This is the highest one. If I use this trend line anywhere in between those two x values, then I'm doing interpolation. But I could use it either lower than the lowest one or higher than the highest one, and that would be extrapolation. This, you do the same thing for either of them, but that's how they're distinguished as far as definitions are concerned. Let me show you how to graphically use a line of best fit for interpolation. So let me put some numbers to this just so it's easier to talk about. Let's say this is 1, this is 3, this is 5, and this is 7 over here. Just to give numbers to the tick marks. Well, looks like I did measure at 3. I did use a concentration of 3 molar. I didn't use one at 2, though, and I might say, well, what would the growth rate be if I had used 2 molar? All you would have to do is find 2 on the x-axis, go directly up to the trend line once it's properly fit, or the line of best fit, and then go directly horizontally over to the y-axis and read the value for growth rate. In other words, this is saying, if this line of best fit is actually describing the overall correspondence between growth rate and nutrient solution concentration, then you should be able to predict values for growth rate that you didn't actually test the corresponding concentration for. Okay? It'll give you a Y value for an X that you didn't actually test. That's why it's a prediction. So those aren't measurements. The measurements are the dots. The predictions you get without actually going through with it based on interpolation. And that is interpolation because it's between these two extents. I could say, what is it for a half molar? You would use the same process, but that would be extrapolation because it's either lower than the lowest or higher than the highest value that you actually measured. Notice that I could do extrapolation over here as well. Let's say I wanted to know what it is at 11 molar. Well, the line of best fit suggests that it would be a growth rate way up here. I said that one of these two methods is much more scientifically safe. That's interpolation. You generally want to avoid extrapolation because you can't assume that this trend that the line indicates continues indefinitely. You know, you might have just happened to choose concentrations that are within a linear range, but if you got it too strong and actually measured it, it might drop off and kill the plant. And by using extrapolation here without actually getting these measurements, you would be falsely assuming that it's going to grow like hell when actually it's going to die. Interpolation is much safer because it's based on a range that you actually tested for. And the more different concentrations, in this case, the more values of the independent variable you have, the more sure you are of that fit, because it involves more lines. For instance, is it really like this, and you just happen to pick these lines that are these points that are on a line? Well, probably not, but it could be. You add more points, though, and if they're still linear, then you're even more sure. Okay, not all dependencies, by the way, are linear. This one just happens to be. Go ahead.
So the event where, just like you did the axe.
Yeah.
Then in that case, we are going to say that maybe the control variables now play a role if we're not having a straight best fit line.
If there isn't seemingly any trend at all. Like if you just get a cloud of points, then that is not true dependence either, usually. But even what looks like a cloud of points, you know, you can have a cloud like this. It's still an overall linear trend. There's just variation in your measurements. So this is why we usually leave it up to the computer to find the line of best fit. But you should be able to do it by hand for the purposes of this report and for this course in general. All right? Did that answer your question? Probably not.
No, you did. Okay. My thinking was that if we are weighing the graph and we're having curves on it, then I was looking at, we talked about the controlled variables, which you or the scientist is going to play on it.
Yeah.
So in the event you're having this kind of curves, does it mean that either the plant is not being watered, the plant is not being fed with the nutrients, that is why you're having the decline in upward aspects?
Right. If you don't do a good enough job of controlling the controlled variables, they are part of the reason why they aren't exactly on the line. That's part of the error in measurements, is that some of these things that really you're trying to eliminate by controlling those variables, they actually can have some effect, so it's not exactly on the line. But the more careful you are, the more they should line up, if it's truly a linear relationship, which it doesn't have to be. All right, now, everyone's straight with all these important concepts. I just want to say a couple words about how you can do things wrong today. In any given experiment, you should strive to do things correctly simply because that's the right thing to do. But you definitely want to strive to do things the right way in an experiment that you have to write up as a report, just because it's a bitch to write up things when you make a bunch of mistakes. It's harder to explain away. It'll be a lot easier to make your report if you have good data, which means making careful, correct measurements. Now, we have glass beads up here. This is extras, but there's already some in this strainer. These are just boiling chips to keep it safer so that it doesn't superheat when you heat these solutions. If it superheats, it can actually get hotter than boiling before it actually starts bubbling, and then all of a sudden it can spurt out, which can be dangerous. But the beads will prevent that from happening. So you just put, say, 3 of these in each of your flasks that you're boiling before you fill them with liquid. And you'll hear them clinking as they heat up. That'll keep it from going out of control. But we don't want the glass beads to go down the drain. So when you empty your solutions after you've gotten your measurements, you want to pour it through the strainer into the bucket so that this catches the glass beads. And in case it's not obvious, if this bucket is almost full, don't try to bring it up to the limit before you spill more in. Take the strainer out, pour the water out into the sink, put the strainer back, collect all the glass beads. That's really not about doing things carefully. It's just so that you do it. Another thing, though, by the way, is that you're going to make a mess. And so be good to the staff so that they don't have to clean up entirely. when there's any spillage of today's liquid, it's not going to just dry. Yes, the water will evaporate, but it's going to leave behind salty residue. So mop up any spill that you make before you leave. Back to making careful measurements, though. First of all, what is today's independent variable? Not salt. That's not specific enough. What?
The amount of salt?
That's not specific enough.
Molarity.
Yes, the molarity. The concentration expressed in molarity of the solution. And so you have four values, right? 0 molar, 1 molar, 3 molar, 5 molar. This reminds me of another point about graphing. This happens every term, so I can almost guarantee that some of you will do this, even though I'm telling you all not to do this. 0, 1, what did I say? 0, 1, 3, and 5?
Yeah.
Some of you will do this. 0, 1, 3, 5. What's the problem there? Well, it wouldn't be a problem if instead of these numbers you had colors. Yellow, green, red, blue. It would be reasonable to evenly space those to make it look nice, right? That's a categoric axis. They're just categories. They're unrelated to each other. But this is a numeric axis. And numbers are related to each other, and the distance between 3 and 5 is not the same as the distance between 0 and 1. So number your tick marks and spread them out, put them to where they should be, right? Because if you don't, it'll affect how they line up. If they're spaced differently, that's going to be a different line, and your interpolation will be incorrect. So don't do this. Okay? Another thing, though. Oh, well, let's finish that thought about the variables, though. What is the dependent variable? Right. The temperature at which the solution boils, which is also known as the boiling point. This brings up another way that you can make a mistake. What is boiling? Is it the very first tiny bubble that appears? Or is it a roaring boil? Or somewhere in between? It matters. And you as a group, before you start the experiment, need to come up with an agreement as to what actual boiling is. And make the measurement there at that point for each of the solutions. You don't let one simmer and call it boiling and another one full boil and call that boiling. It'll matter. Also, you don't want to use a full boil for an unrelated reason. For the pure water one, it really wouldn't matter. This isn't the graph you're going to give me. I'm just going to graph temperature versus time. If I were continuously measuring the temperature while I heated pure water, obviously over time it would go up in temperature, right? Eventually, though, it would hit a flat plateau. And that's because when you hit the boiling point of water, you can keep adding heat, but that extra heat doesn't raise the temperature. It just goes into converting more and more liquid into more and more gas. And it will stay exactly at the boiling point until all the water's gone. Well, that means you could measure the temperature any time in this flat part and you would be correct. So it doesn't matter with the 0 molar. But for all of the ones that have salt in them, it does matter. Because once you hit the boiling point of the salt solution, if you don't get the temperature right away and allow boiling to continue, what's happening is that salt water is not evaporating, just water is. You know, if you forget your boiling salt water at home and 3 hours later you come back to the stove and say, oh yeah, I forgot all about that, you'll have no water in the pan and solid salt on the bottom. But somewhere in between that time, if you just keep boiling, you're losing water, but you still have the same amount of salt, so that makes the solution higher and higher concentration. you don't want to change that concentration, right? Because it's something that you're adjusting at a defined level. That means you want to get the temperature immediately upon your definition of boiling. And the best way of doing that, by the way, is to already have the thermometer in there before the boiling occurs, because it doesn't have an instantaneous response. It takes a while for the thermometer to equilibrate. So have it in there already, ready to read. And also, importantly, the probe of the thermometer needs to be entirely under the surface of the liquid, but just as importantly, it shouldn't be touching any glass, especially the bottom. So don't just put it in there and let it rest. You need to carefully ensure that it's not touching any glass to get the best possible temperature. Okay. Anything else? Anything that you are wondering? You can get through this pretty quickly, but before you do anything, since we're dealing with hot stuff, you need to put on and keep on goggles on your eyes, not on your forehead. The goggles are all back there. Just don't forget to put them back before you leave. You probably won't forget. So keep them on. You can crank up your heaters, because you can always turn them down if they're too hot. But get them cranked up, ready to heat. But just remember they're on. Don't touch that white thing after you turn it on. You're working as a group, so you can use multiple heaters and get through it quicker, but it doesn't take long to get these measurements. Before you leave, in addition to cleaning up, though, just make sure that everyone in the group has all the measurements, and then you're done for today.